All right, welcome everybody to the Transportation Policy Conference Committee. How we'll move forward today is that we will have a walkthrough of the DE there, and then we'll have some testimony, and then we'll talk amendments, and then we'll move forward from there. So thanks everybody for being here, and thanks all of the Conference Committee members for all their work and being here. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Happy to be here. I'm excited to get the Conference Committee work rolling. Do we want to have folks go around the table real quick and introduce themselves?
That would
and
be
also,
great.
You kind of jumped over something that I want to visit again.
Mm-hmm.
I think there was a notice that there wasn't going to be testimony. There is going to be testimony. So get ready. Run to the table if you feel so inspired. And I assume we're going to try to keep folks to a couple, 2 or 3 minutes?
Yes, right. For sure.
Great.
Definitely. So if we want to start, let's go, since the House side, let's start this way. Matt, you want to introduce yourself? Yeah.
Matt Bauman, Committee Administrator, House of Representatives.
Matt Burrows, House Research.
Kyle Schwab, DFL, House Caucus Research.
Frank Hornstein, Chair, Transportation, Finance, and Policy Committee, District 61A, Minneapolis.
John Petersburg, Transportation Minority Lead.
Joe Marble, House Research for the GOP.
Nate Pasco, Senate Research for the DFL.
Dave Frazier, Senate GOP Research.
Dom Linetti, Legislative Assistant to Senator Jasinski.
Senator Jasinski, Minority Leader of the Minnesota Senate in District 19, Faribault, Otano, Sika.
Alex Will, Legislative Assistant, Senator Dibble.
Kathy Thier, Committee Administrator for Senate Transportation.
Krista Boyd, Fiscal Analyst for Senate Transportation Committee.
Tim Greenfield, Nonpartisan Counsel for the Senate Transportation Committee.
And Mr. Chair, we're missing Senator Morrison, who's the Vice Chair of the Committee and conferee. She's in the Environment Committee right now. They're just now getting to their finance bill. But late, and so she's pinned down handling amendments and the final vote on the bill. Hopefully she will be here soon.
Perfect, and we will delay any official action until she gets here to go through stuff. So we're gonna start first with a walkthrough of the DE as it stands currently. So Mr. Burris and Mr. Greenfield, however you'd like to proceed with that walkthrough.
Mr. Chair and members, I'll be starting off, and this is the delete all amendment. It's coded A24-0313, and I'll just do a high level. We'll trade off at a couple of points, and as always, we can go to questions if there's a follow-up on things. So the DE amendment starts with Article 1, which covers a variety of policy provisions. Section 1 revises the membership on the Advisory Council on Traffic Safety. This reflects the Senate language with a couple of additional, or at least one more additional member and a clarification around possible changes to board structure. Section 2 has a compensation provision for salary studies for law enforcement officers, and this reflects the Senate position. Section 3 modifies the rules or eliminates a rule and codifies it on a accident prevention course, setting the length of the course at 4 hours. This reflects the House effective date. It was a provision in both bodies. That'll just pause to note that a large number of the provisions were either same or similar between House and Senate. For the most part, I won't go into the details on the technical differences, and I'm trying to do is just note spots where there was a policy difference or a House or Senate only. Otherwise, you can I think it would be pretty safe to assume that it's identical or substantially similar language between House and Senate is what's in the DE amendment. So then moving to Section 4, this modifies the call procedures for certain rail-related incidents, how the contact, emergency contact works. Moving to page 6, there's a series of sections 5 through 7 that provide for a trunk highway turnback as well as an additional trunk highway route, kind of a rerouting and additional naming of a trunk highway, establishment of a trunk highway in the statutory structure. Section 8 is a Senate-only provision, and this establishes a memorial highway for Senator David Tomasoni. It's the Senator David J. Tomasoni Memorial Cross Range Expressway. Section 9 is also a memorial, and this was a Senate provision, and it establishes the Mayor Dave Smigluski Memorial Bridge. Apologies for butchering that one. Sections 10 and 11 make modifications to a couple of MnDOT contracting preference programs to up the percentage preference. Section 12 is the first of a series of sections that are spread throughout, and this deals with rotable aircraft. So the first couple of sections here in Section 12 and Section 13 go to definitions. There are several other provisions involved. At a high level, this is house-only language that establishes a motor vehicle or a type of vehicle that is regulated as a motor vehicle on public roads, is registered as a vehicle like any other passenger-type automobile, has a difference in license plate provision where a decal is used instead, and then can also operate as an aircraft and is subject to the various aeronautics regulations in airports and similar aviation-related locations. Sections 14 and 15 modify motor vehicle definitions in the chapter on vehicle registration, Section 14 on pickup trucks, Section 15 on adding teardrop trailers to the recreational vehicle definition. Section 16 is also related to that with a modification of the trailer definition. And then Section 17 sets some limitations around the vendors involved with self-service kiosks, which are involved with motor vehicle registration transactions. Section 18 is another piece of the rotable aircraft provision. This is the part on decals instead of license plates, or one of the pieces of that. And then page 12, section 19 modifies a veteran service group special plate to broaden the eligibility. Section 20 is a house provision that makes a technical change on clarifying an annual appropriation. Section 21, as I mentioned, there are several of these, is one of the rotable aircraft provisions. This is on the vehicle registration and titling as a motor vehicle. It sets out those requirements. Section 22 sets limitations related to deputy registrars and deputy, driver's license agent appointments. These limitations are on the third-party information technology vendor that dealers would use. And then Section 23 is a house-only provision on data sharing involving leased motor vehicles. And this does, in the DE amendment, have a change to broaden the data sharing authority to motor vehicles more generally rather than just passenger automobiles. Section 24 provides for foreign passports to be used as a document. And this has the Senate effective date of day following final enactment. And then on page 15, section 25 modifies towing restrictions involving when a vehicle has unpaid parking tickets. Section 26, as well as section 27, make definition changes that are, again, related to rotable aircraft. Section 28 has a definition of non-divisible load, and this goes along with a later section in the DE amendment. And this uses the House language, which has some technical revisions in comparison to the Senate language. Section 29 defines rotable aircraft. Section 30 through 33 relate to crash reporting. This is a combination of House and Senate's provisions, and then that includes some language that was in the on the Senate side, clarifying a couple of aspects around use of terms and definitions, and then some House language as well, particularly on the or one of the aspects was on the, oh, that was later, sorry. The House section was section 30, I believe. Jumping then to page 20, section 34 makes modifications around U-turns and driving rules related to reduced conflict intersections. Section 35 is one of a few sections that are, again, scattered throughout that modify the name of an endorsement to be a motorcycle endorsement, which would refer to two- and three-wheeled vehicles when endorsement is required. Section 36 makes a couple of modifications related to safety zones to eliminate the safety zones concept that's largely obsolete. And this section includes House language. Oh, I'm sorry, that's a different section. My apologies. There's a couple other safety zone provisions that are elsewhere in the DE amendment. Section 37 makes a modification to defining a separated roadway. This includes the safety zone, removing the safety zone term, but also updating the types of separation in the phrasing and terminology. Section 38 codifies what was a temporary provision allowing for supplemental warning systems on school buses and makes some modifications to the requirements around that. That was a Senate-only provision. And then Section 39 allows for ground lights on motorcycles in some circumstances. This was also Senate-only. Following that, there are a series of sections 40 through 43, that define terms and set requirements that are or revise requirements around child passenger restraint systems. And this continues until page 26. So there's a series of cross-reference changes, requirements for use of the restraints based on various characteristics such as age and height and weight limits of the individual being transported, and then some technical changes that go along with the restructuring. Section 44 on page 26 of the DE is another piece of the rotable aircraft. This goes along with the license plate requirements or non-requirement of a license plate, if you will, for rotable aircraft. And then section 45 is the other piece of the divisible load provisions that lays out the substantive requirements for when a load is required to be broken down or when a special permit could be sought for a load. And then that brings us to section 46 regarding implements of husbandry, and Mr. Greenfield is going to speak to the modifications that are in the DE for that.
Mr. Chair and members of the conference committee, Mr. Burris is correct that there were some modifications to the driving operation rules language that was in both the House and Senate bill, but the and with a fresh set of eyes, I made some technical rewrites to the underlying section pertaining to when an implement of husbandry may be operated or towed to the left of the center of the roadway. The same requirements do apply, but they just make more grammatical sense. And of note, in the clause one, the two Roman numeral references, those specify specifically that the implement must cross the center line for as brief a period of time as possible to avoid the obstacle, and the implement returns to the right half of the roadway immediately after passing the obstacle. This was a slight language difference than what the House has in their provision, so it is carried forward from the Senate, but clarified in a more easy to read and technically proficient way. Section 47 is a Senate-only provision that pertains to sewage septic tank trucks being able to haul overweights, weights that are over the specified limit during certain specified emergencies. Section 48 is the authorization for a special sugar beet hauling vehicle permit in certain areas near the North Dakota border. Section 49 on page 29 is the second section as part of the sewage septic tank overweight authorization permit. Section 50 on page 30 is, as Mr. Burris referenced, some technical changes to the motorcycle endorsement on a driver's license or on a driver's license. This provision, I believe, is adopting House technical languages. So there was a minor technical difference between the House and the Senate, and that House language is incorporated in the delete everything. Section 51 on page 31 are the operational requirements for a rotable aircraft. This specifies certain flying operations and road operations for the vehicle and when it may be considered an airplane versus when it may be considered a vehicle on the road. Section 52 on page 32 is a provision from that is in both the House and the Senate that pertains to the invalidation of a driver's license. This removes and repeals the requirement that the officer physically clip the credential. Section 53 on page 33 is another definition clarification to provide that a rotable aircraft is not a motorcycle. Section 54 on page 33 is, and section 55 are two provisions that pertain to the definition of a non-compliant license. There were some minor technical differences between the House and the Senate, and the Senate language is incorporated in the delete everything. Section 56 is the same provision from both House and Senate that pertains to the definition of a state to include a U.S. military base located on foreign soil. Section 57 is another provision pertaining to the motorcycle endorsement. Section 58 on page 34 is clarification and some technical changes to the contents of an application. This language is carried in both the House and the Senate. I believe there were some minor technical differences between the body, and I believe beginning on section 53 through 58, section 58 as well as section 59, section 60, and all the way to section, apologize, there's a lot of sections, 65. Beginning, or 64, beginning on page 51, are all part of the underlying DVS policy bill that involve the codification of certain identity and residence documentation requirements for purposes of a driver's license or identification card. So it looks extensive, but essentially it is moving and what is currently into rules into statute, and there were minor differences between the bodies that have been picked up throughout these sections. Section 65 on page 51 is permitting the veterans, expanding the number of eligible people for a veteran's designation on a driver's license or identification card to include honorably discharged members of the National Guard. Section 66 is a technical change to the tribal identification card as part of the aforementioned codification of certain identity documentation rules. Section 67 is a House-only provision that pertains to caretaker information on a driver's license, instruction permit, or identification card to repeal the limit of only up to three individuals receiving being designated on the electronic record. Section 68 is a provision that is a Senate-only provision, Senate File 4823, that pertains to the TSA Clear Registered Traveler Program that authorizes the Division of Driver and Vehicle Services to perform identity verification as part of requirements for that program. Section 69 on page 54 is additional technical changes as a result of the codification for identity documentation. Section 70 is a waiver that pertains to the motorcycle endorsement, so it's part of the other technical changes described by Mr. Burris pertaining to a motorcycle endorsement on a driver's license. Section 71 is another endorsement classification change. Section 72 on page 56 is a hybrid of House and Senate language pertaining to road test examination reporting. The frequency of the report from the House of requiring a report on January 15th and July 15th of each year is included as the frequency of the reports required by the department, but the contents of the report is Senate language, and Of note, the effective date on page 57, line 26, is January 1, 2025, to make the first report due not until January 15th of 2025, as opposed to requiring this on July 15th, when the bill would be default effective on August 1. Section 73 is a minor, is a technical change pertaining to a limited license pertaining to criminal vehicular operation. There is a policy difference between the House and Senate, and the House language did prevail. Was incorporated into the A24 0313 delete everything amendment. The House set certain one-year waiting periods for limited licenses after criminal vehicular operation in various circumstances and disallows the license under various circumstances for certain types of criminal vehicular homicide. Section 76 is the same provision for the House and Senate pertaining to online driver's education. Section 77 is a same provision pertaining to the transportation highway performance resilience sustainability measures. Section 78 on page 61 is a provision that pertains to the Safe Routes to Schools program. That's the same in both bodies. Section 79 on page 61 is a House-only provision pertaining to the Transportation Facilities Capital Program. Section 80 on page 62 and section 81 on page 63 pertain to MnDOT's responsibilities and powers to carry out promotional activities for passenger rail activities. Section 82, beginning on page 63 through section 88, that ends on page 70, are House-only provisions that pertain to modifications for excavation notice system, the excavation notice system known as Gopher State One Call. There are a variety of changes, but that, the entirety of the House language was carried forward into the Delete Everything Amendment. Section 89 and 90 are Senate-only provisions that pertain to certain rail clearances. Section 91 on page 72 is a Senate-only provision that pertains to the National Emergency to when a declared national emergency occurs, the hours of service for the transportation of certain fuel products. Section 92 on page 72 is a provision that is a cross-reference and a conforming change to the next section on section 93 on page 73 that expands the ability of individuals 18 to 21 to transport certain petroleum products rather than under current law where they may be prohibited to transport certain aggregated individual containers. Section 94 is a definitional change, adding the definition of roadable aircraft to the aeronautics chapter of law. And Section 95 is a law's 2023 provision that my colleague, Mr. Burris, will pick up from here.
Mr. Chair and members, the following sections make modifications to the transportation legislation, finance legislation enacted last year. The first of these, Section 95, revises an appropriation for disaster support, so broadens how the funds can be used. That language is found on page 76. Section 96, also on page 76, modifies the location and a little bit of uses of an appropriation for US Highway 52. Section 97, starting on page 76 as well, modifies an appropriation that was for a township. That's to change the some of the procedures around the allocation of the funds and the purposes, uses to which the dollars can be put. And then Section 98 revises one of the appropriations that was made from Trunk Highway bond proceeds in last year's transportation finance bill. And this references the Transportation Facilities Capital Program that Mr. Greenfield had outlined that's earlier in the article of this DE amendment. Section 99, along with the following couple of sections, sections 100 and 101 and 102, also make modifications to last year appropriations so that the funds are not established as grants, but rather go to MnDOT for administering the dollars, as well as eliminating one of the requirements around availability of the funds. And then on page 79 of the DE amendment, section 103 was a house-only provision that directs MnDOT to use the latest federal manual in speed studies until the equivalent MnDOT manual is updated, or those portions are updated. Section 104 provides for limited licensing agents in some circumstances to be able to seek to become full service providers who provide both deputy registrar and licensing type services. Section 105 was a house only provision and directs planning by the State Agricultural Society on state fair transportation. And then section 106 contains a number of repealers. These are for the most part related to some of the provisions outlined previously. On paragraph A, eliminating references and the concept of the safety zone. There's also an elimination of requirements to provide social security number in application for a Real ID compliant license. There's an elimination of a negligence provision in civil actions related to underground facilities that goes along with the Gopher State One Call set of provisions. And then a age limitation on certain petroleum transport is also repealed. That's being replaced with something that's substantially similar and broadened requirements. Paragraph B contains a repeal of some statutory provisions as part of the driver's license and identification documentation requirements that are being centralized in the bill. And then paragraph C eliminates an administrative rule on hours of instruction for third-party testers in commercial driver's license training. Finally, paragraph D eliminates a accident prevention course administrative rule, which is replaced by the statutory language. And then, Mr. Chair and members, Article 2 contains a number of provisions that the Department of Transportation had proposed related to Greater Minnesota Transit. The first of these are a series of changes to definitions, and I'll just go over this at a high level. The second basic change is to establish a new type of service class. The article also contains modifications to financial assistance procedures, a revision to a report. It eliminates rules and rulemaking authority, and then has a repealer that also is part of the elimination of the rules and some terms that are also removed. And that, Mr. Chair, is an overview of the DE amendment.
Thank you very much, Mr. Burris and Mr. Greenfield. I appreciate it. Now we will take testimony, so I'm not sure if anybody has things they'd like to say about the bill because it's glorious and nearly perfect. So we're there. Is that all right? Representative Petersburg.
Can I just ask one quick question?
Absolutely.
In regards to the rotable aircraft, as Chair Hornstein says, there's an awful lot in here about that. But my question is, did we clarify whether or not this is classified as a motorcycle or not in regards to driver's license endorsement?
Thank you, Mr. Representative Petersburg. Senator Dibble and I were commenting on the fact that it is like half the bill as well. So we appreciate all of your work on the rotable aircraft. Mr. Burris.
Mr. Chair, Representative Petersburg, a motorcycle endorsement is not required under this language, and that was what was revised in the House language as it moved through the process.
Thank you.
Any other questions before we go into testimony? All right. Seeing none. Representative Senator Jasinski, sorry about that.
On the section, it's R-59, the excavator notice system. Can we have someone, we haven't really heard that language. Do we have anyone to testify to make sure there's peace in the valley and the stakeholders are okay with that? We haven't heard that in the Senate, so I just want to see if anybody can comment on that just to make sure we have agreement or
yep, that
peace
was
in
great.
The valley.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator.
As Ms. Pisick makes her way up, of course we want to hear that, you know, there's a proverbial broadly shared agreement, but if you could also just for the benefit, for the good of the order, let us know what all the elements are that are carried. I mean, I know we just had the walkthrough, but maybe in more
sure.
Civilian language, kind of what the key elements are. Mm-hmm. And
of course, an indication of broad agreement. Thanks. Hey, state your name for the record and please proceed.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Sarah Pasek, and so I'm representing AGC, the Associated General Contractors, and there are 400-plus members that include general contractors, specialty contractors, affiliated businesses working in highway, heavy, and commercial construction. So we first want to thank you very much for including the provisions and the changes to the Chapter 216D, which is the utility locating and underground excavation notice system. And yes, there is agreement after many, many meetings. I'm trying to look around and see if lots of those folks are in the room, but we met with Office of Pipeline Safety, MNOPS, quite a few times, Gopher State One Call, and then all of the utilities, large and small, across the state, cable, I think anybody that was interested, locating companies, anybody that was interested, we talked to and worked through language. There was many changes, many versions of what is in the bill today, which was adopted on the House floor on a voice vote with, you know, actually no discussion because it has been agreed to. I don't have the provisions. I didn't bring them up in front of me, but I talked about it so many times, I can tell you, that what it does is it works to increase communication during a locate process. So there's things such as adding a definition of locate to statute, definition of locate period. We change right now, current law says that you have to locate within 48 hours. We add a little bit of time to that to say not including the day of notice, which was something requested by a lot of folks. We add provisions relating to both the pre-construction meeting and the construction meeting, which are aimed at including improving communication. So what is the length of the project? What is the exact location of the project? What, you know, how will that be done so that there is a better understanding of exactly what needs to be marked, when it needs to be marked, and by who? We included a provision about having a company's name on flags, which from the excavator's point of view, sometimes you hit something and you're not sure exactly who's line it is, especially on telecommunications a little bit more. So that was an important provision. We included a big section that originated with MNOPS about construction meetings and how that happens. There's a provision in the bill that will require new utilities installed after January 1, 2026 for most utilities, and then a later date, another extra year for smaller utilities. The new utilities have to be marked with GIS. The location needs to be marked with GIS, which is a really big improvement. Going, you know, our contractors said it might not improve in their excavating in their lifetime, but going forward, there it'll be a big improvement. So that's only for newly installed utilities or facilities, or newly abandoned if the ground is open at the time. I think those are the major provisions that were included and changed, but happy to answer any questions. And like I said, it was a pretty collaborative process.
Thank you so much. Senator Jasinski, any follow-up?
Nope, thank you.
Thank any you. Further questions from folks? Okay, is there anybody else that would like to testify?
I just want to say thank you again, and we really appreciate this being in there.
Thank you so much. Is there anybody that has anything they'd like to testify about the bill? And if not, we'll recess until Senator Morrison arrives. All right, seeing none, we'll be in recess. Thank you. All right, we will reconvene the Transportation Policy Conference Committee, and we've already done the walkthrough of the bill. We've taken testimony, and now we're going to work on amendments. And so we have a few amendments here, and we welcome Senator Morrison to the proceedings. She's only a little ticked at me that we started without her, but it's all right. We'll all get along together. So thank you, everybody, for that recess, and we will start with the A22 amendment from Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I offer the A22 amendments. And members, this is a simple change to what will be the newly established Department of Transportation Facilities Program. Is that right? Something like that.
Capital Facilities.
Capital Facilities Program. And this maybe is like, what do we call a belts and suspenders amendment? It simply says that those facilities that will be receiving funding through this newly established program are subject to the sustainable building guidelines, which they are anyways, but we're just making sure that that is spelled out clearly in this section.
Thank you very much, Senator Dibble. And I should note for everyone that everything is, these are posted online. So if anyone wants to check these out, these amendments are online. Questions on the 822 amendment? All right, we will move to a vote. So we're voting on the 822 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? The amendment prevails. All right, now we'll go to the 823 amendment. Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, the 823 is technical in nature. It clarifies and or establishes some accounts within special revenue funds. I'll have Ms. Boyd help me with this.
Ms. Boyd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a technical amendment. These are provisions that are largely currently in the Senate Finance Bill that just clarify account and fund language to match current practice under MMB. The first, several of them have to do with the Motorcycle Safety Fund. This is, for all intents and purposes, an account within the Special Revenue Fund, so this is changing the statute to reflect that in the first section starting on 1-4. And then there's two other sections I'll point out that have to do with that. The next section starting on 1.19 is a similar provision. This is sort of old drafting style where accounts were created in the state treasury. They are actually located in the special revenue fund. So this is technically making that correct. The next two sections on page 2 starting on 2.5 and 2. Oh. 2.5 also has to do with the motorcycle safety account, making a conforming change there. Also, there's another section already in the DE that has to do with the motorcycle safety provisions. So lines, sorry, I'm jumping around. Lines 2.1 through 2.3 are just putting this change into a section that's already in the bill. And then on starting on 2.17, this is one that is not currently in the Senate Finance Bill. To my knowledge, it was, this is a change to language that was in last year's capital investment bill, Chapter 72. A new active transportation account was established in the general fund. There is already one in the special revenue fund, and sort of general rule is we don't create new special accounts, specialized accounts in the general fund. So this is getting rid of that superfluous account and putting that fix here.
And Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
And Section 81 was supposed to be picked up in the earlier capital investments kind of fix-up bill and somehow got dropped, and so we're just picking that up here.
Beautiful. Discussion. All right, seeing no discussion on the A23 amendment to the DE, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? The motion prevails. All right, now we're going to move on to the... So the A19 amendment, Senator Dibble, or is this Senator Jasinski?
Sure.
The speed limit study one.
I'll allow Senator Jasinski to take the lead on this, if he would so desire.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. What this does on the speed limits for below what a street is designed for, I know MnDOT's going to love another report, but this is a report that would actually study the analysis on the lower than recommended speed limits for their design. So for the 20 mile an hour that we're seeing in some of the cities. So again, we have some concerns. This just goes through a few things that studies the impact on traffic and some of those things. So with that, I'd offer the A19 and hope it's considered as a friendly amendment.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
So I'll speak in favor of the A19. I think it is, it was a positive change when we allowed cities to lower their speed limits on the streets that they own and operate. I think the Elkins Carlson provision directing the Department of Transportation to adopt the speed section of the MUTCD, the Manual on Uniform Traffic Control Devices, also very positive. I do think it is appropriate for us, though, to maybe focus the attention on local municipalities on ensuring that they're paying attention not just to putting up numbers on a sign that establish speed limit, but the design of their roadways that support those lower speeds. And I could tell my personal anecdote if you want, but the fact of the matter is this is very, very hard to drive 20 miles per hour on a really wide road that's built for 40 to 45 mile per hour. And so part of this, I think, is to focus municipalities' attention on all the elements that go into lowering speeds in a real authentic and holistic way.
Perfect. Thank you, Senator Dibble. And from the House perspective, I encourage a yes vote on this as well. Is there any further discussion or questions? All right, seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Anyone opposed? The motion prevails. All right, so we've got that one done. Now let's do, we need to do an oral amendment to the trooper pay portion of the bill. I neglected to add an effective date on this. It was in the House language, so I will make a motion that we accept the language from the side-by-side, page R3, lines 410 through 412. On that language. Mr. Burris, is that anything to add on that?
Mr. Chair and members, I think that about covers what I would outline. So this would be in addition to the effective date that's on page 3 of the DE amendment. So it would be additional language that goes after 3.21, and it's the language that's found in the policy side-by-side document R3, lines 410 to 412, establishing an effective date is the day following enactments with an expiration and an application clause.
Thank you very much, Mr. Burris. Any questions? Senator Jasinski.
Mr. Chair, I just asked, wondering why you want that removed. You know, is the Senator Howe provision, and just asking why you'd want to remove that date?
It is not removing the date. It's adding the effective date, and there was significant, this was a mistake on my part that this should have been added from the House language on here, because there was significant discussion with MMB and other folks on this language as negotiated, and I told them that we would be including it, and it works together with the sunset of the current audit that happens. So I've been working on this part of the bill since 2019 when I was first here, and so this is an important piece to make sure that there's for lack of a better term, peace in the valley from everyone to accept this and moving forward to make sure it works. Senator Dibble.
So the effective date, we definitely need an effective date, and then we're also picking up the sunset date, which is lines 410 to 412, correct?
So, correct.
Extending this out to 2032.
Yes.
All right. And I think that might have been the gist of Senator Jasinski's question, why the sunset, and if you could just restate why we're sunsetting it.
Yeah, so the sunset is to, it's not intended to sunset. The goal of this is to make sure that troopers stay, that we have trooper pay that is equitable to law enforcement across the state of Minnesota. And so this language relies on an audit that is done. And so this language relies on that audit, and that audit has a sunset on it as well. And so that was the agreement between MMB and our team as we were working through this language. And this language is also approved by the Troopers Association as well. So this is approved by Troopers Association, MPPOA. If I recall, there's a whole slew of folks that approved and agreed to this language. And we can find those letters if you would like. But it's this is the language that we passed in the House first and added that in there. So,
okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you.
Any further discussion? All right, seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Anyone opposed? The motion prevails. So we've got that one done. And now we've got the A51 amendment, which should have just been passed out. Has that one been posted online? It's gone through a couple of different versions on things, but this has exam reports. Do you want to take this one, Senator Dibble?
Sure. I'll be the author of it. I'll offer the A51 unless one of my teammates wants to offer the A51.
Go ahead.
It did originate from our counterparts. Actually, I think it originated with Representative Petersburg, and then we added and we accepted the something along these lines as an amendment on the floor when we had the policy bill up on the floor. But then we've had some conversations both with the House as well as with the agency. Part of the changes are practical in nature in terms of what the agency can actually measure and deliver to us in the form of a report. And then we had some conversations, you know, if in fact examinations are being handled in a way that we would expect, that would diminish the need for the report. And so with that, as a frame up, maybe Mr. Greenfield can help us understand what we're asking for here. The gist of the issue, of course, as everyone is aware, that we're frustrated with people's inability to schedule driver's license exams and tests and the like. We're hopeful that should the finance bill prevail with the governor's position to add staffing, that those problems will dissipate and or disappear. But in the meantime, we want to be understanding the levels of service that is being provided and whether or not people are being subject to delays or long drives and things like that. Mr. Greenfield.
Mr. Chair and members of the
proceed.
Mr. Chair and Senator Dibble and members of the conference
this
committee.
Is the House. We're not that formal.
Oh,
okay.
Well, I'm wearing a tie still. Senator Dibble is correct that this has undergone some revisions from the House and Senate language that's currently in the side-by-side. I will note that the intent of this report is to have a twice-a-year report with slightly different kind of look-back periods. So if you note on paragraph B, beginning on page 1.12 to 1.16, this sets the frequency of this exam scheduling report that requires a report by March 1st and September 1st, with the report on September 1st being due to include information for the most recently ended fiscal year, which from September 1st is about 2 months from the end of the fiscal year at the end of June, July 1st. The report due March 1st must include information for the most recently ended calendar year, which would be January 1st. So this gives the department about 2 months to pull the necessary data and provide the reports as specified in the new subdivision 10. And so from there, the report's operational requirements is kind of a two-pronged approach, which is, again, slightly different from the House and the Senate, to first identify performance measures or metrics established by the commissioner related to scheduling availability and the passage of road tests, and for that reporting period, identify the results for those performance measures or metrics. And if a goal is not met as part of those goals, then a second report comes in for that same reporting period, which requirements are specified and borrowed substantially from the Senate language on lines 2.6 to 2.20. So I'm happy to break those down in more granular detail for the second report, but essentially the first report's purpose is to allow the commissioner to provide metrics as to scheduling availability and the passage of road tests, determine whether the commissioner is meeting those performance standards, and if they are not meeting their goal, then the secondary report to identify the sources of those delays, in addition to further geographic breakdowns that are required as part of the Senate language, is then required of the department.
Thank you, Mr. Greenfield. So thank you. This is kind of a mashup between the House language and the Senate language. We found a happy place in between those for a variety of reasons. But does anybody have questions? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It looks like Amendment 51 and 50 are very similar with the exception of the second page. Will the 50 be offered as well, or, you know, is the 51 the updated version?
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. The 51 is the updated version, yes.
So 50 we can discard at this point?
Correct. You can discard 21 and 50 if there was a 21. So the 51 is the update of the 21 and the 50. Mr. Greenfield.
Mr. Chair and Representative Petersburg, I just want to explain the reason for the change between the A50 and the A51. In the Senate language that's currently in the side-by-side, there was a requirement that the department compare based on an applicant's residence data, based on a 50-mile, 100-mile interval, or 200-mile interval. That would require an additional service to be contracted with DVS to be able to perform that calculations, and it raised a host of fiscal and data privacy issues that, quite frankly, weren't within the ambit of the report. So we opted to go within criteria that DVS identified as criteria already being able to be pulled from bin drive systems.
Perfect. Thank you. Further questions?
Senator Jasinski. I don't have a question, just maybe a comment. I mean, I would think all the information from 2.6 would be valuable, so, you know, whether it meets the metrics or not. So I would think those, you know, those items described there, you know, why are we not doing those if the metrics aren't met? Just, I think it's something, the information would be good no matter what. So my question is, why are we, only if they meet the metrics, that they do the second thing. So I would just like to see them done at all the time, so we have that. I think it's valuable information that we could use to continue to improve to our driver's license program and how it's being delivered with commercial and Class D.
Was that a statement or a question?
Kind of both.
That's what I thought, too. Which would you like it to be?
I'd like to be a question. Why are we not doing it all the time? I think that's, again, valuable information that we could be using to continue to improve our system in the state. We've seen plenty of problems with it, and I think with some new people, we'll catch that backlog up, but I think it's something we could use as valuable information. I guess, why aren't we doing that?
Yeah, thanks, Senator Jasinski. So this was my request on here, is that we need to make sure that we have enough information to make decisions based on those things, but not too much to be onerous on the department so that they fall behind on what they're able to provide and to do. And so if they are meeting their benchmarks and they're getting what we would like to see from the legislative perspective, then it's I think I'm in good shape and we're in an okay place on that. But if they're falling behind, then we'll know, and we'll know that we need to take action on that. So that was the thinking behind it.
Thank you. And then just to continue, so I know one of the biggest things was how far people are having to travel, and that's, it seems like the language was watered down from the A21 to the A51. So that's getting watered down as far as, you know, that's important information. I know I hear about a lot of people have to travel 200-300 miles to take a test, and we're also seeing some numbers that we saw that a lot of the suburban people are going to metro or going to the rural spots, causing rural people to travel even farther. So, you know, you're coming down 25 miles into my district, and then my residents have to travel 200 miles to go up to there just because of the way the schedulings work. So I think that's an important thing to look at, as far how far our people are traveling to take these tests.
Mr. Greenfield.
Mr. Chair and Senator Jasinski, I just wanted to identify that the two criteria that are carried forward in the A51 that must be collected are the applicant's county and exam station region. So if an applicant had to travel outside of their county or outside of their exam station region, that would be logged as having to travel for purposes of the appointment. The change was to remove zip code as one of the three criteria, because arguably a person moving across a zip code to take it doesn't necessarily constitute the same level of potential travel that may occur under existing DVS programming to identify a far distance as opposed to you know, one zip code to another or one county to another. There's at least a little bit more difference and distance that can be studied as part of the decision to go with county data or exam station reporting data, rather than indicating the rate at which someone has to travel outside of their zip code, of which someone may not even live within a zip code where an exam station is available. So that was the idea, to kind of clarify the data a little bit further.
Senator Jasinski.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Greenfield. Further questions? Discussion? Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I recall, and we talked a lot about this in the 2021 conference committee, we have 93 stations, as I recall, and then isn't there something that there has to be a contiguous county? And I guess, I don't know if DVS is here, but I wanted to know if that's still the case.
Director Zhang is here and is on his way up. Did you hear the question, or did you need it restated?
I did hear the question.
Please state your name for the record and proceed when you're ready.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Pong Zhang, Director of the Driving Vehicle Services Division. And yes, we do have 93 exam stations currently active in the state of Minnesota. And yes, there is a requirement in statute that an exam station has to be in a county or an adjacent county. Currently, we are in compliance with that requirement.
Chair Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So do you have data on the maximum amount of miles one would have to travel even under this scenario?
Director Zhang.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Representative Hornstein, I believe we could calculate kind of what's the maximum distance you can travel from one end of the state to the other end of the state. Where I think we're going to have challenges if we're going to get into specifics of one individual applicant's residential address to a specific address in the state. That's where we're going to have to, it will increase the cost of this work, and we'd have to do some programming in our system to be able to do that.
Chair Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I mean, that was not my question. It was just simply, you know, we're not talking about one end of the state to the other. It's just, you know, even contiguous counties, which I think would really be probably an issue for northern Minnesota more than anyone, but you know, I think it exists everywhere. I'm wondering if we have any language in this amendment that would address that question. It's more reporting, but geography is important.
Mr. Greenfield, can you help get there?
Mr. Chair and Representative Hornstein, I don't believe that the geographic proximity criteria are included in the A51 because of concerns that Director Zhang identified with existing MnDrive data to be able to run these reports. So I believe that, you know, adding the additional complication to make that comparison was a challenge at this late stage.
Thanks. Just wanting to get some perspective on that. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much, Ornstein. Senator Dibble.
Couple of things. One is, we're going to get some sense of whether people are driving hither and yon to get their exam.
Yeah.
But we won't have the level of granular precision for all the kind of technological and, you know, just practical and privacy reasons. They would probably have to buy, as I understand, geolocating software. I mean, it's just, you know, usually I'm like skeptical of some of these barriers that get erected in front of good ideas. But in this case, I think that makes a lot of sense. But I do know, I mean, and Director Zhang did present a report when we were hearing the governor's budget proposal that showed that a lot of Metro people are leaving Metro, clogging up the greater Minnesota exam stations. You know, some coming in to the Metro to get their appointments, but far fewer. So somehow or another, the agency is already able to get some sense that people are unable to get an appointment near where they should be having their appointment, near where they live, and are going out to other places. And this is hopefully going to give more detail around that as well, just not the level of precision that you're looking for.
Or that I'm looking for. I'm with you, Frank.
Further discussion. All right. So we're on the A51 amendment and seeing no further discussion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Anyone opposed? The motion prevails. All right. Now we have the A25 amendment. Senator Dibble, do you want to do this one or who likes to take this one?
Sure. So, Mr. Chair, this has to do with an effort to clarify an appropriation we made in last year's finance bill, which tries to get some funds to a township which is in the Metro, which is an orphan, because it's much, much larger than any other township, and frankly, it's larger than 5,000 population, but of course, Beacon Township, it doesn't qualify for MSA funds, and before you ask, why don't they just become a city. They don't want to for their own reasons, and that's totally fine. And so we thought, well, we'll take some pity on them, similar to what Senator Croon is attempting for a small city in the metro right now. It's just a unique circumstance. So we saw fit as a legislature to address at least on a one-time basis because they have a terrible situation with their local road system, and so we're supporting them in that on a one-time basis. However, it's the funds have gotten snared up in some of the particulars in how these types of funds, which are construed as grants, are handled at the agency, and so we're just clarifying it's not subject to all the normal kinds of processes that the agency engages in when sending money out to local units for their road purposes. So, Ms. Boyd, anything to add? This is like we've made many different passes and attempts at trying to get the language right. And MMB and MnDOT have said, that's not right. So this seems to get us to what we want. Ms. Boyd.
Mr. Chair, that's my understanding. If there need to be further refinements, we can continue that in another venue as people review it. But based on the conversations we had before committee, this should be adequate for our purposes.
So, Mr. Chair.
Senator Dibble.
So it is my intention, and I'm going to invite my fellow chair and anyone else who would like to join to follow this, should it prevail and be passed into law and signed by the governor, with a chair's letter saying, you know, this is our intention. We're not running this grant through the state aid process, and please just let's move on. Let's get the funds where they're needed, and let the township get about fixing its roads. Thanks.
Ms. Boyd.
I'm just going to have a little sidebar. One second.
Oh, while they're having sidebar, any further questions or discussions on this? All right. Take just a moment. Right. Senator Dibble.
So, Mr. Chair, the iterative process of continuous improvement continues, and through the magic of the interwebs, additional language has been beamed in from the agency that would help. So if you're amenable, Ms. Absolutely. Boyd has an oral amendment to propose to add to the language.
Ms. Boyd.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is a little longer than I'd prefer for an oral amendment, but this is what we have before us. This is at the suggestion of MnDOT to make the intention of this appropriation crystal clear. So if we are so amenable, I will suggest that after A on line 1.6 of the amendment, after paragraph A, insert a comma and insert "and may do so without complying with Minnesota laws and policies regarding grant management, including but not limited to the requirement to have an agreement." And we can get that written up for the purposes of the committee, and I can repeat it if need be.
Please repeat it, yes.
So on line 1.6, after paragraph A, insert a comma and insert "and may do so without complying with Minnesota laws and policies regarding grant management, including but not limited to the requirement to have an agreement." And Mr. Chair, just commentary, that seems to be the essence of what we're trying to get to here, and would just be another layer of assurance for the agency, I believe.
Chair, I'll move that oral amendment, lengthy though it is, if you're agreeable to taking it orally and not in writing.
Yeah, definitely. I think that is okay. Does anyone have questions or further clarification on that piece? Does MnDOT have anything they'd like to say about this? It's not necessary. Just checking. Okay. All right.
So we have an oral amendment to the A25 amendment. Any further discussion on the oral amendment? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Anyone opposed? All right, that oral amendment passes, and now we've got the A25. Any further discussion we need on the A25? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
Anyone opposed? The motion prevails. The A25 is accepted. All right, so now we've got a couple more. There's an A49 amendment. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I think these next two amendments actually refer to the great Minnesota get-together that we all enjoy in the summertime, and I do that as well. And, you know, way back when, it's hard to believe, but every person that needed to park could actually park on the fairgrounds, virtually everybody. And now the fair has grown bigger and bigger, and brings in more and more people. That has expanded to the point that now we have busing available from various lots around. Met Council does some of them, and our opt-outs do quite a few. Now, remembering that the opt-out groups, those that are not part of the Met Council, are usually in the suburbs, so driving farther distances back and forth, and oftentimes carry people like me from greater Minnesota that comes up to Minnesota and carries us to the fair so we don't have to try to find parking close by. This amendment actually just says that those groups, replacement services providers, would be able to charge the appropriate fare, not to exceed what the actual costs are, but they don't have to if they don't want to, but would give them the authority to actually provide the service at a cost that at least allows them to break even. And I know that there's some concern about whether or not those constituents and residents from that area will have to pay higher fares. And yes, that is true. However, those of us coming from greater Minnesota who like the service, if we aren't paying our fair share, the local residents are also paying for us as well. And so it seems like the best way we can do is allow for those establishments, those providers, to provide the ride at the rate possible. Now, it doesn't preclude them from giving discounts if they want to for others as well, but this just seems to me makes sense that we shouldn't expect the cost of providing a bus from 15 miles out to be the same as those providing it from just 4 or 5 miles out from around the fair. So that's my amendment, and I think it's certainly appropriate.
Thank you very much, Representative Petersburg. Discussion. Senator Dibble.
Mr. Chair, I'm listening to the debate and the conversation. Curious to know how others feel. I do know that there has been a long-standing policy of trying to keep fares uniform, similar to the idea that first-class stamp is the same price whether you're mailing it down the block or across the country. There's a reason for that policy. This would put us down the path of changing fares for one kind of service provider versus another in the metro area. So that would be my concern. That is this just a beginning of breaking with that established policy? You know, the reasons for which maybe someone can remind us, Mr. Chairman's here, others are here, why we have that policy so that we can just consider this proposal in light of that. Or maybe this is fine. Maybe this is just about the state fair and we're good to go.
Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, and you're absolutely right. However, we wouldn't expect to have the same airline ticket price if we're going from Minnesota to Iowa versus Minnesota and Arizona. And so there are times in which we have to account for the distance and the cost. Now, if the Met Council and others would include into the cost of the fare the additional costs of those outside the area, that would be one thing, but we're not doing that in this case. And because this is a special event in which primarily the state fair used to take care of it by itself, now is being asked of the providers to provide this option, it makes sense that this is basically a one-event process, and it is special for the State Fair, and it is the language specific for the State Fair.
Thank you very much, Representative Petersburg. Further discussion? This would directly affect my district and my residents. I think probably also Senator Morrison's district and residents as well. And I'm opposed to raising these fares just on certain folks. This would only apply to West, Southwest Metro, and Southeast Metro, basically. The rest of the Metro wouldn't have an increase in fares. So I'm, as Senator Dibble was discussing, I think it's important that we keep things uniform across the Metro. And so I, for that reason, I oppose this amendment. Further discussion? Senator Dibble.
Sure. Could we hear from Mr. Shettman about why we have that policy? I'm not necessarily saying this is setting that precedent, but it might be setting that precedent and starting to open up the door to differentiating our fares. I'd say the distinction, of course, between airlines and public transit is, you know, public transit is a public good, supported, you know, not designed to turn a profit. And, you know, if we had public airplanes, maybe that would be a different conversation.
Rotable aircraft.
Yeah, there we go.
Rotable public.
Mr. Shettman, please say your name for the record and proceed.
Great. Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. My name is Judd Shettman. I'm the Government Affairs Director at the Met Council, and I appreciate the question. I have been texting with our folks over at Metro Transit. The amendment wasn't posted, so we're trying to just get a quick handle on this. But Senator Dibble is correct. We do have a kind of a uniform fare policy. I think the policy has more to do with making sure that we have consistency across the region and that we want to make sure that there isn't an issue where things become a charter service, where you're charging one fare in one area and a different fare in another area, and looking for that consistency about where you're coming from. And that's how we've approached this in the past. I can appreciate Senator Petersburg, you bringing this forward, but I believe it has much more to do with this uniform fare policy. It has to do with making sure that everything is the same in the metro area, so we don't have an issue with it becoming looking like a charter service when it is public transit that's providing that ride. That is the best that I can come up with based on what I'm hearing back from our folks.
Thank you. Senator Dibble, do you have a follow-up? Representative Petersburg.
Thank you for that. And I would still, again, argue that when the governing board that decides what the fare is dealing with trying to determine what is the appropriate fare within a certain geographical area, and does not include those areas outside of that geographical area on what the costs are, that is also unfair. And I think that's something that should be addressed, and maybe it will be addressed later. But for that very reason alone, it makes sense that when you're farther out, based upon what the decision was made on what the fares should be, that you are incurring greater cost, and that also has a telltale cost.
Yeah. And Mr. Chair and members, I think, you know, we have the regional fare policy related to our express service as well, which is region-wide. We have different lengths along those lines. I think one of the issues is that the State Fare Service isn't part of our regular route bus service, and that's where you get into the issue related to charter service. But I understand your point, and I am not our expert on this, but I believe that that is kind of what the issue is here. Thanks.
Thank you, Mr. Shettman. So any further discussion on the A49 amendment? I'm on the right one, right? A49?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you. Any further discussion on the A49 amendment? All right. Seeing none, Representative Petersburg, do you have anything else you'd like to say? Sorry, I just want to make sure.
No, just that I think Mr. Shannon said exactly the right words. All the other stuff was dealing with regular routes. This is not a regular route.
Thank you, Representative Petersburg. All right. On the A49 amendment, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay.
No.
No. The motion does not prevail. All right, friends, that is the final amendment that I am aware of that we have today. Is there any other amendment that we need to...
We're not doing the 20?
No, the 20 was requested to be pulled, so we are not doing the A20. Any further amendments? All right, so we are through amendments there. So now we'll have final discussion on the DE for House File 3436. Any further questions, discussion on 3436? Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just really want to thank the chairs for some really good work here. You're able to get this done very quickly and cooperatively, and really appreciate this. I think this is a very good bill and updates a lot of work that we did last year and then moves into some other areas that we need to get into. So it's a good effort, and appreciate both chairs' work on this.
Thank you, Chair Hornstein. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you. And I would echo the same comments, that it's been appreciative to actually be worked with all the chairs and Chair Hornstein as well, because I think this bill shows a lot of transparency and a lot of working with each other, understanding each other. We may not agree on all aspects of the bill, but it certainly isn't because we haven't talked about them enough. So I appreciate that, the extra work, the extra time, spending time with me, who is just one member of the minority here. I just thank you for that.
Thank you, sir. Senator Jasinski.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and as well, I want to thank Senator Dibble and Senator Morrison. We have a lot of our bills in here, and if you're looking throughout many other bills and committees, there's not a lot of Republican policy in some of these bills, so we do really appreciate that. We've had a good working relationship for, I think, 8 years now, so it's good to have that, and it seems like this is one of the highlights of the legislative sessions is the transportation policy. Overall, the bill I'm happy with. There's, again, I still want to bring out the one issue that I have in this bill is the unlimited parking tickets without being towed. I do not like that. That is something that I just can't believe that we can't put even a higher amount on there or so many within a year. We made amendments on the floor for 100 and 1,000, and it was voted down on party lines. I think at some point, if you take all the tools away from law enforcement, if someone's breaking the law, it's a shame. And so that's my concern with the bill. But if you look at that one item versus the rest, I can't vote against it, but I still really have concern of why we're doing this and why this is in the bill and why that got voted down. I mean, if you can have 1,000 unpaid parking tickets in this state and not get your car towed, something's wrong. So my only big concern, Senator Dibble knows it well, I've voiced it many, many times. Representative Petersburg is smiling too, because he's heard me on this bandwagon for a while. I just think it's unfortunate that we're doing this. So other than that, I support the bill and thank you for your work as the chair of the committee, and look forward to moving on.
Thank you, Senator. Did you want to say anything? Senator Dibble.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just to echo the thanks, and of course, just I want to go down the line here. I won't name everyone by name, but the staff here is spectacular. So thank you for all of your hard work. It's just and the fellows over here who helped us out. It's really, and of course, everyone on this side too. It's been said before, but it bears repeating. You know, we look good because you all do such incredible work, and this place would not function without all of your really, really hard work. I'm very grateful for my committee, for my friendship and partnership with Senator Jasinski and our Vice Chair, Senator Morrison, and I'm grateful to you for our great working relationship, and I think we put together a good package in fairly good order. And so this was a great process, and congratulations to Representative Hornstein on the arrival of his granddaughter today.
Oh, wow.
Yay. First granddaughter, very exciting. So, Mr. Chair, I can move the package, if you so like.
I would like to say something first, yes, if that's all right. I just want to echo what everybody has said, and so thanks, everybody, and thank you, for Senator Dibble, for working so closely together on this and figuring out ways where we can square things off where there were differences in the bill, and it worked pretty well. And there's a lot in this bill from both sides of the aisle, and so that's a really good thing, in my opinion. So I just want to thank specifically Chair Hornstein for allowing me to take on this task and going forward with this, and just for your trust in me and getting this done and where we're at, and Lee Petersburg for all of your work together and getting here. So thank you very much. And to our folks the Mats and Kyle and Joe Marble. Thank you very much. I don't know if they prefer me calling Mats or not. We went elder Mats. And younger Love for a Mats. Little bit, and that was not well received. But it has just been really good working together with everybody to get to this point. So thank you very much. I just want to note one thing that I'm specifically very proud of in here is the trooper pay part. We've been working on this for a really long time to get here and allow this to make sure that our state troopers are paid on par with law enforcement across the state of Minnesota. And that's a really good thing to have and important for the future of our state law enforcement. So I just appreciate everyone's work. And so it will apply to BCA and to DNR and other folks in that bargaining unit as well. So it's a good thing moving forward. And I appreciate everybody's work, especially in MMB helping us get there. So thank you. With that, we will take a motion to adopt the bill.
So, Mr. Chair, I would move the adoption of the Delete Everything Amendment as amended. Yep, getting there. we always forget as amended, so they're always reminding me. As amended. As amended, the A24-0313 Delete Everything Amendment to House File 3436. With all of the additional provisions allowing staff to make the necessary technical changes and revisions and grammatical elements, et cetera, so that it's shipshape by the time it's turned into a conference committee report for our signature. That's my motion.
Thank you very much. So Senator Dibble moves to adopt the A24-0313 amendment as amended as the conference committee report and direct nonpartisan staff to make any necessary technical and conforming changes.
Thank you for that.
Yes. Beautiful. Any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Anyone opposed? The motion prevails. So we have a conference committee report. So thank you very much, everybody, for your great work. Thank you to everybody who contributed to getting us here. And now we all get to go work on finance bill and keep going there. So do you have anything you'd like to say before we adjourn?
Get some rest because we keep rolling.
Beautiful. With that, we are adjourned. Thank you, everyone.